This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It's been 3.5 grim years since Russia launched an unprovoked invasion of its Ukrainian neighbour. Ukraine's capacity to resist has depended on two things: its own will to fight and support from its allies. Until January this year, the US was one of those allies. Then things changed. But in the last week, President Trump seems to have taken a turn against Russia. The US president said he was very unhappy with President Putin over the lack of progress towards a ceasefire agreement to end the war in Ukraine. On Monday, the White House announced 100% tariffs on countries which do business with Russia. Those tariffs to begin in 50 days' time unless a ceasefire with Ukraine is agreed. President Trump also announced that the US would be sending weapons to Ukraine which NATO allies, and not America, would pay for. So, is the tide turning in the Trump-Putin relationship, and could this change the course of the war between Russia and Ukraine? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's find out from our world affairs correspondent Paul Adams what the current situation in Ukraine is. Paul, you've recently come back from Kyiv. How would you describe the situation?
Clearly, the advent of Russia's repeated huge-scale drone attacks on Ukrainian cities, something which has just gone up and up and up in the last 3 or 4 months, has changed the atmosphere. I think people in Kyiv and perhaps in other cities too had become, if not blasé, then certainly used to occasional attacks from the air and the kind of sense that there was a war raging, but generally speaking at a distance. That sentiment is completely gone now because you go to bed every night thinking, is it Kyiv's night tonight or is it Lviv's night tonight? And when it is your night, it goes on for hour upon hour. The sound of the drones buzzing overhead is absolutely constant. You can hear them dive bombing in a way that's almost reminiscent of the kind of Stuka bombers of the 1940s. So that is a terrifying sound. And of course, you hear multiple explosions going on, air defense, the whole thing. And it goes on for hours. And you're constantly wondering, is it going to hit me? That's quite a new thing. And it is having a corrosive effect on morale. I think that is the kind of thing that has changed most in the last, say, 5-6 months. Because actually, in other terms, the war on the front lines in the East, that really hasn't changed a great deal. It's the same places. It's the same glacial Russian progress, which is so slow it is hard to discern in many places. There's no sense that Ukraine's front lines are going to collapse. There's no sense that Russia is any closer to achieving its goals of, you know, unseating the regime in Kyiv and conquering the country. So the war is quite static in that sense.
What level of casualties are we seeing as a result of this increased drone and bombing strikes?
Well, they're not huge, but, you know, there was one attack in Kyiv in which one missile hit a building and I think 20 to 30 people were killed in just one go. So it can result in significant casualties at any given moment. Generally speaking, it's not having that effect. Two or three here, one there. But because it is a constant, it does seem to be more salient in people's consciousness.
Let's talk about Russia's drone strategy. I mean, what's it for?
So these big packages, hundreds of drones at a time, and we've come up to the level of, you know, in excess of 700 in one night. They accompany a much smaller number of cruise and ballistic missiles. Those missiles are the ones that do the real damage. They're the ones with the big warheads. They're the ones that are the hardest to intercept. The drones are fundamentally about confusing Ukraine's air defences, overwhelming the ability of Ukraine's home defence to protect the skies. Half of those drones tend to be dummies, decoys, with very little in the way of a payload on them, but they all perform the same function. And of course, some do have a payload and are aimed at targets. And I think sometimes perhaps we are guilty of giving the impression that Russia is just sort of randomly attacking civilian targets across the country. I think mostly these drones, and certainly the missiles, are aimed at specific targets. There are plenty of military and industrial targets inside the cities in Kyiv and Dnipro and elsewhere, which are of important military value. And those are being hit over and over again. There is a military logic, but also one senses that it is about demoralizing the civilian population.
Given the sheer level of ordnance thrown by the Russians at the Ukrainians, from what you're saying, it sounds as though the Ukrainian air defences are not bad.
They're not bad at all. The Ukrainians use a whole variety of systems, from literally guys at the back of pickup trucks with World War II era machine guns at the bottom end, to European supplied air defence guns, which you can hear a deep rat-a-tat-tat at night, some of which sort of send up exploding ordnance which can intercept a drone, to F-16 jets with missiles on board, which can shoot down cruise missiles. And then, of course, at the very, very high end, the Patriot batteries, which are needed to intercept those ballistic missiles, because those are the hardest to intercept.
Is there any significant Russian advance? Is there any anticipation that there will be some great offensive that people always talk about in the future? Or essentially, are we talking about a continuous, very, very slow process that's unlikely to change?
I think it's the latter. I mean, a lot of people talked about a Russian summer offensive. That hasn't really been one. They are still throwing vast resources into this, but they're not moving those front lines significantly. Ukrainian resolve is absolutely, I think, where it has been all along. And their ingenuity and their ability to compensate for their relative lack of manpower and equipment is pretty astonishing and has been all along.
Yes, so one of the things that's characterised this war is extraordinary levels of improvisation.
Yes, when there's a technical innovation at a unit level, that will be very quickly scaled up and turned into a new product. They're so much quicker at that than other militaries. There's a new system now where units can earn points by proving that they have destroyed a tank, killed a soldier. I mean, and because everything's video now, everything's on video, all the drones are filming everything, you send that evidence back to a unit in Kyiv, they analyze it, they award you points on a sliding scale. And now, I think in a few weeks' time, those points can be used on what they call the Amazon of War. You'll go onto a website, you'll put your points in, you'll see what's available, you'll order it, the manufacturer will send it to you directly, and the Ministry of Defence will pay for it afterwards.
So we're talking about a level of unit flexibility, but also learning, which is really unparalleled.
Yes, because all of that data is being looked at in Kyiv to analyse how can we fight more efficiently. And always the emphasis on the Ukrainian side is, how can we do this with the minimum manpower? Whereas, of course, on the Russian side, you get the opposite sense. There's no limit to the amount of manpower they're willing to throw at it.
Paul Adams, as we've heard, Ukrainian citizens are having to endure the constant pounding of their cities by Russian drones and missiles. To find out what this has done to their views on the war and the future of their country, I'm joined by Anton Grushetsky, who's the executive director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology and who conducts regular polling of Ukrainian citizens. Anton, how do you go about polling people in a wartime situation?
It's much more complicated than before the invasion, but still Ukrainians throughout the whole Ukraine are willing to share their opinions and views, and they participate and they provide us honest answers.
You don't find a reluctance to answer because it is a wartime?
No, actually, people are willing to discuss even sensitive topics like territorial concessions, like attitudes to authorities. And Ukrainians, they want to be heard by our authorities, by our Western partners. And that is why people are really sharing what they think about war.
Now, I was thinking about what would happen in Britain in a wartime situation if, let's say, there was polling which the government didn't find particularly useful. So I'm going to ask you this. Does the government try to interfere in any way in your polling or your use of the results?
Actually, our experience is an example that there are no authoritarian tendencies in Ukrainian society significant, because as sociologists, we feel no pressure from the government bodies. And we ask questions on different topics like war and peace, attitudes to authorities, and actually like the security service of Ukraine, other government bodies are interested in public opinion and high quality. And they even just ask to provide some information, but not asking to do something. So we really feel free in our activities.
Right. Thanks, Anton. So let's now get on to what your polling is showing you 3.5 years after the Russian invasion.
Lots of people are disappointed and concerned about Ukraine's future, and we should divide this into 2 points. First of all, yes, we see more and more pessimism among Ukrainians, and our recent survey showed that only 43% of Ukrainians see that in 10 years Ukraine will be a part of European Union and will be a prosperous country, and 47% think Ukraine will be a destroyed country. And even half a year ago, in December, 57% were optimistic and only 28% were pessimistic. On the other hand, still the majority, around 60%, say they are ready to suffer the war as long as it takes to achieve some success for Ukraine. So yes, Ukrainians are tired. Yes, Ukrainians are concerned about Ukraine's future. But at the same time, Ukrainians will not surrender and still show will to continue resistance.
When you dig down into the polls, what kind of variations do you find in those figures? Firstly, how sharp is that deterioration in people's pessimism? And second, does it depend where in Ukraine they are, or is that across the whole of the country?
For this moment, we surely see these downward tendencies, for example, regarding optimism. After the full-scale invasion started in 2022, almost 90% believe Ukraine will be a prosperous state in 10 years. Now it's 43%, so it's 2 times less. It's an obvious tendency. But at the same time, when we ask a question about how long are you ready to suffer a war, at the beginning it was around 70%, now it's around 60%, so decrease is very light. And you're right asking about differences, but because it was typical for Ukraine to have regional differences for different questions. But for this moment, we could say that only in the south and in the east, we have slightly higher number of Ukrainians are ready to accept some peace deal. But even in these regions, actually, the majority are against any like peace at any cost. And as sociologists that study Ukraine for more than 30 years, we could say that for this moment, we have between Ukrainian regions much more in common than differences.
Do you find any differences between age groups?
No. Between all age groups, we see relatively the same tendency, with majority saying they're ready to suffer war as long as it takes. Particularly males eligible for army ages, while in Russia the younger respondents are much more against war, in Ukraine all age categories are ready to continue resistance. And the question why? Because in all age groups we see the understanding, clear understanding that the war is existential, and people, regardless of age, of sex, of education, of settlement type, of prosperity level, understand that like it's existential threat for us, and we have no other choice but to continue resistance.
Now, what is your polling tell you about whether people are willing to accept territorial concessions or the extent of territorial concessions as part of any peace deal?
If we're asking about like temporary occupation of some areas by Russia without official recognition and with some like prospects for Ukraine, for security guarantees, European Union membership, over 60% could accept such a scenario. If you are asking about official recognition of some territories as part of Russia, or like even giving up on territories that Ukraine control right now, like cities of Kherson or Zaporizhia, absolute majority says surely no. So Ukrainians are flexible. They could accept some temporary territorial losses, but Ukrainians want in exchange some security guarantees, some socioeconomic prospects, and surely no official recognition, because like Russians shouldn't be rewarded with the aggression.
Right. What do people think about the US and Europeans as allies at the moment? How's that shifted?
It shifted heavily because after the full-scale invasion, the absolute majority of Ukrainians perceived both the US and the European Union, the European states, as Ukrainian allies. But since this year, since we have new administrations in the US, we see totally different situations. While in case of the US, 58% thinks right now that US is tired of Ukraine and wants unjust peace for Ukraine, just to end the war. As for the Europe, more than 60% say that Europe is still Ukrainian ally and Europe still wants just peace for Ukraine. So yes, Ukrainians say United States is not our enemy, but it's not our ally for this moment. As for Europe, it's perceived as our ally, and actually still the absolute majority of Ukrainians see Ukraine as part of European Union and wish to be a part of European Union.
Now, this may be an impossible question to answer from the polling, but to what extent could you see the increased pessimism amongst Ukrainians about the future of the country being linked to their diminished trust in the United States?
You asked a very right question, because over the last half a year, the key factor was behavior of the United States. Lots of people were demoralized by this behavior because United States was perceived as our closest strategic ally. It was like stabbing in the back, lots of Ukrainians feel, and it also affects prospects of future. When Ukrainians feel this reliable support from our closest European and North American allies, Ukrainians, I feel, we are able to achieve success in war. We are able to rebuild our country, recover, and become finally like land of dream for us. But when we feel our partner leading democracy in the world behaving like this, surely it's disappointing.
Anton Grushetsky. And before we carry on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about Trump's latest tariff hokey-cokey, and in the week when a child in Liverpool died of measles, the one which asks whether vaccinations should be compulsory.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to Ukraine. We've heard what's happening on the ground in Ukraine and the state of public opinion there. But how significant is President Trump's threat of tariffs on Russia's customers, and what does his announcement on weapons mean in terms of the potential course of the war? To discuss this, I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, defence editor at The Economist, and Angela Stent, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former US national intelligence officer for Russia. Angela Stent, we heard earlier that Ukrainian morale is linked to a perception of whether the US supports them. So I think the question is, does it at the moment? Has Trump changed since that catastrophic meeting with Zelensky at the end of February?
So I wouldn't go as far as saying that he's changed. He's obviously moderated what he's saying. He's irritated with Putin because he's come to realize on one level that Putin is playing him. But even if you listen to what he said a couple of days ago when he announced that Europeans would buy American Patriots and other weapons and then give them to Ukraine, you know, he was giving Putin 50 days. 50 days is a very long time. He sort of again said that he's not on either side of this conflict. He said that he wouldn't give weapons to Zelensky that could be used to hit St. Petersburg and Moscow. So I think if I were a Ukrainian, I would be very cautious about believing that there's been any genuine change in President Trump's view of this. It's just that he wants to appear to be a successful peacemaker, and he realizes that Putin is thwarting him in this ambition.
Let's just talk, Shashank, about the weapons deliveries issue, the idea that these very sophisticated and expensive weapons could be sold to NATO countries who would then give them to Ukraine. Now, how significant do you think that is?
It's incredibly significant because, frankly, Europe cannot provide certain categories of critical munitions. We've talked about them many times before, but they include Patriot air defense systems, which are necessary to parrying the ballistic missiles that Russia fires at Ukraine. European air defense systems are very good, but they're not optimized for that ballistic threat, which comes in at much higher terminal speeds than a cruise missile or a drone or a plane. Additionally, there are some precision-guided rockets, things like the ATACMS ballistic missile, that are very important that the Europeans simply don't have. So the Europeans can do a lot by themselves. Ukraine can do a lot by itself. Certainly, its production of shells has been soaring. But there are certain key things that really only the United States can provide, even if Europe had the money for it.
So, Angela, why has he chosen to do it this way? I mean, is there some internal American politics in this?
Well, there certainly is. The vast majority of senators, including most Republicans, are very much still in favor of supporting Ukraine and also of imposing much tougher sanctions on Russia. He also wants to placate those people within his party, his base, who don't think we should be supporting Ukraine and that we, you know, that this is not our fight.
Shashank, how should we read this? Should we read this as this is a way of giving Ukraine what it needs, but having some kind of not plausible deniability, but making it less politically difficult for the Trump administration? Or is it effectively saying, well, we don't really support you, we're just going to make the Europeans do it instead?
It depends how optimistic you're feeling, David, but I would say it's avoiding the worst case scenario of a complete US cutoff of all support, which would have grave ramifications for Ukraine on the battlefield eventually. It's certainly a long-term diminishment of US support.
One of the questions that arises from this, Shashank, is whether the European NATOs can actually afford to pay for the amount of munitions that Ukraine is going to need from the US.
It is. You know, I just got back from the NATO summit in The Hague a few weeks ago, and NATO allies agreed to spend 3.5% of GDP on defence, which, as you know, in most cases is well above the existing level of spending. You cannot really make up tens of billions of dollars in foregone US aid and continue to rearm yourself at the same pace under these circumstances. I think there is an exception, which is that some aid to Ukraine has been paid for by skimming off the profits from frozen Russian assets in Europe. This could prompt a fresh debate on whether more of that money should be skimmed off to pay for this kind of support.
Right, okay. Let's move on to the question of tariffs. Anja, can you explain to me exactly what it is that the administration's been saying? I mean, I kind of understood the bit about putting tariffs on those countries who trade with Russia and give Russia the money that it needs to continue the war. What I haven't understood is whether there are supposed to be extra tariffs on Russia itself. Can you take us through what's being suggested?
Well, there have been contradictory statements since Trump first announced this a couple of days ago. There could be extra tariffs on Russia, but in the US case, it's not really meaningful. We barely trade with Russia. So it's much more important to look at when they're talking about countries that import from Russia, particularly China and India, the major purchasers of Russian oil, also Turkey, and then other countries presumably that purchase weapons from Russia.
So it could be that countries like Turkey would be looking at the end of 50 days, if there's not a ceasefire agreement, if he carries through with that, at tariffs in addition to the ones that he's already imposed.
Right. Turkey, a NATO ally, will be looking at that, yes.
Shashank, who is the threat actually to here? Is the threat actually to China and India and Turkey, or is the threat to Russia? Because it's after all, it's Russia that's got to agree to a ceasefire.
I think the threat is really to everyone. It's to the Russian trading partners who are, you know, sort of engaged in this, and it's to the Russians to say, we can try and collapse your trade. But of course, the problem I have is, it just, given what we know about Donald Trump's commitment to Ukraine, the level of importance he attaches to this issue, it simply isn't credible that he will reshape his relationship with China, which is in the midst of a very delicate balance over tariffs and rare earths and chip exports, over an issue, Ukraine, he has demonstrated not to care very much about. So my worry is this just isn't a credible threat. And if Putin, looking at the end of 50 days, won't be very afraid. And indeed, I should point out here, David, the Russian stock market, I think, rose by 2.7% the day after Trump's announcement.
I'm very glad you mentioned the Russian stock market, because one of the things that Steve Rosenberg, the BBC correspondent in Moscow, was putting out in the last couple of weeks have been some very nervous statements in the Russian press about the shape of the Russian economy. And I'm wondering whether the famous strains on the Russian economy aren't really beginning to show now.
They are beginning to show. You know, on the one hand, you have a wartime economy that has had fairly high rates of growth and has been able to overcome some of these sanctions. But I think the fundamentals are quite weak. And so I think if there were more sanctions on Russia, then it could be more problematic for Putin. But I think we have to remember that so far, the Russian official reaction to what President Trump said has been dismissive and, you know, as if they don't take any of this seriously.
Shashank, I suppose the other big issue is the question of the extent of which any change in the Russian economy actually impacts upon its capacity to wage war.
Well, it will over time, because, of course, Russia has to churn out many of its munitions and weapons itself. It's getting some from North Korea. It's getting support to defense industry from China. But it's got to refurbish tanks. It's got to build new armored vehicles. It's got to build new artillery barrels. All of these things have now, in a sense, reached their peak because Russia has used existing capacity to breaking point. But it now has to start building new plants, new factories. I don't think it can do that without a continued supply of funds. And I think that over time, you would begin to see consequences for its own army. The only thing I'll point out, though, is that I think a lot of this war at this point is as much about manpower as it is about munitions. You know, it's about whether each army can replenish the very high losses on both sides, particularly on the Russian side. That in turn also depends on finances, because the Russians are recruiting about, I think, 10,000 to 15,000 more troops per month than Ukraine, but they are doing it with very generous sign-on bonuses and salaries rather than sort of forcible conscription, and that costs a lot.
Shashane, let's look at how the war's changing. Obviously, on the Ukrainian side, we've seen prodigious levels of improvisation and the use of new techniques and the filtering down of successful new techniques right the way up from the ground where they're being maintained and then out to other units. What do you see as the principal developments?
The principal development, I'd say, is not so much technological right now as it is the Russian offensive and the fact that the nature of the battlefield, which we've discussed many times, the fact that you can see everything from drones and satellites, you can strike things more easily because of cheap precision munitions, means that no one can do big conventional offensives with large formations. And if you look at it fundamentally, and I'm drawing on work done by my colleagues at The Economist, the current Russian offensive works out at about 15 square kilometers per day. I think they compare that to the size of Los Angeles Airport. And over the past year, if you crunch the numbers, the Russians have gained about 0.038 square kilometers, so 9 acres per dead soldier. And the bottom line for me is that if you want to then take the rest of the four oblasts that Russia claims, Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, Zaporizhia, that would take until February 2029. Mr. Putin's gamble is that Ukraine's breaking point will come well before then and before Russia's, but I am doubtful that he can easily continue the war until that date.
Angela, that's actually a slightly more kind of precise estimate from Shashank than I was expecting. Would you concur?
Yes, I think some people think the Russians can at least continue the war for a couple more years. But we have to remember that if Russia has a mobilization problem, the Ukrainian mobilization problem is even greater. And we have much more evidence now of particularly young men of draft dodging and things like that. You know, this may help Putin in his attempt to crush Ukraine sooner rather than later.
I worked out that in 6 months' time, Ukraine will have been fighting Russia for longer than the Soviet Union fought Nazi Germany. So my question really is, if they can solve their manpower problems or kind of maintain them, Shashank, can this war just go on forever?
It can go on for a very, very long time. And I think that in Europe, there has to be a realization that just because you want a peace deal doesn't mean you'll get one. And this could go on in some ways for, you know, a decade, although it would have to wax and wane. Each side would have to reduce the intensity of operations. If American aid were to be cut off, I think that that would make it significantly harder for the Ukrainians to stay in the conflict. But I think there's a perfectly good chance, to put it more simply, that this war goes on through 2026, to sort of give a slightly shorter timeline on it.
Angela, do you agree?
Yes, I agree with that. And I would say if you look at the longer time, as long as Putin remains in power and he has now staked his existence, his legitimacy, his ability to remain in power on crushing Ukraine and ensuring that it doesn't survive as a separate, sovereign, independent state, that war will go on unless something else intervenes.
And that's all we have time for. My thanks to Angela Stent and Shashank Joshi, and also to Paul Adams and Anton Grushetsky. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Ben Carter and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The editor is Richard Varden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
Hello, my name is Alex von Tunzelman, and I want to introduce you to History's Heroes, the BBC's breathtaking, high-stakes, story-led podcast shining a light on extraordinary people and ordinary people who become extraordinary, including a pioneering surgeon who rebuilt the shattered faces of soldiers.
You know, he would look at these men and he would say, "Don't worry, Sonny, you'll have as good a face as any of us when I'm done with you."
And the woman who created the international charity Save the Children. Subscribe to History's Heroes on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.